This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Corrie Samuel. The History of England, from the Accession of James II, by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Chapter 6, Part 20. In truth, the crisis was only beginning. While Clarendon was trying to lean on Rochester, Rochester was unable longer to support himself. As in Ireland, the elder brother, though retaining the guard of honour, the sword of state, and the title of excellency, had really been superseded by the commander of the forces, so in England, the younger brother, though holding the white staff, and walking, by virtue of his high office, before the greatest hereditary nobles, was fast sinking into a mere financial clerk. The Parliament was again prorogued to a distant day, in opposition to the Treasurer's known wishes. He was not even told that there was to be another prorogation, but was left to learn the news from the Gazette. The real direction of affairs had passed to the Cabal, which dined with Sunderland on Fridays. The Cabinet met only to hear the dispatches from foreign courts read. Nor did those dispatches contain anything which was not known on the Royal Exchange, for all the English envoys had received orders to put into the official letters only the common talk of antechambers, and to reserve important secrets for private communications, which were addressed to James himself, to Sunderland, or to Peter. Yet the victorious faction was not content. The King was assured by those whom he most trusted that the obstinacy with which the nation opposed his designs was really to be imputed to Rochester. How could the people believe that their sovereign was unalterably resolved to persevere in the course on which he had entered, when they saw at his right hand, ostensibly first in power and trust among his counsellors, a man who notoriously regarded that course with strong disapprobation? Every step which had been taken with the object of humbling the Church of England and of elevating the Church of Rome had been opposed by the Treasurer. True it was that, when he had found opposition vain, he had gloomily submitted, nay, that he had sometimes even assisted in carrying into effect the very plans against which he had most earnestly contended. True it was that, though he disliked the Ecclesiastical Commission, he had consented to be a commissioner. True it was that he had, while declaring that he could see nothing blameable in the conduct of the Bishop of London, voted sullenly and reluctantly for the sentence of deprivation. But this was not enough. A prince, engaged in an enterprise so important and arduous as that on which James was bent, had a right to expect from his first minister not unwilling and ungracious acquiescence, but zealous and strenuous cooperation. While such advice was daily given to James by those in whom he reposed confidence, he received, by the penny post, many anonymous letters filled with calumnies against the Lord Treasurer. This mode of attack had been contrived by Tyrconnel, and was in perfect harmony with every part of his infamous life. The King hesitated. He seems, indeed, to have really regarded his brother-in-law with personal kindness, the effect of near affinity, of long and familiar intercourse, and of many mutual good offices. It seemed probable that, as long as Rochester continued to submit himself, though tardily and with murmurs, to the royal pleasure, he would continue to be in name Prime Minister. Sunderland, therefore, with exquisite cunning, suggested to his master the propriety of asking the only proof of obedience which it was quite certain that Rochester never would give. At present, such was the language of the artful secretary, it was impossible to consult with the first of the King's servants respecting the object nearest to the King's heart. It was lamentable to think that religious prejudices should, at such a conjuncture, deprive the government of such valuable assistance. Perhaps those prejudices might not prove insurmountable, Then the deceiver whispered that, to his knowledge, Rochester had of late had some misgivings about the points in dispute between the Protestants and Catholics. This was enough. The king eagerly caught at the hint. He began to flatter himself that he might at once escape from the disagreeable necessity of removing a friend, and secure an able coadjutor for the great work which was in progress. He was also elated by the hope that he might have the merit and the glory of saving a fellow creature from perdition. He seems, indeed, about this time, to have been seized with an unusually violent fit of zeal for his religion. And this is the more remarkable because he had just relapsed, after a short interval of self-restraint, into debauchery, which all Christian divines condemn as sinful, and which, in an elderly man married to an agreeable young wife, is regarded even by people of the world as disreputable. Lady Dorchester had returned from Dublin, and was again the king's mistress. Her return was politically of no importance. She had learned by experience the folly of attempting to save her lover from the destruction to which she was running headlong. She therefore suffered the Jesuits to guide his political conduct, and they, in return, suffered her to wheedle him out of money. She was, however, only one of several abandoned women who at this time shared with his beloved church the dominion over his mind. He seems to have determined to make some amends for neglecting the welfare of his own soul by taking care of the souls of others. He set himself, therefore, to labour with real goodwill, but with the goodwill of a coarse, stern, and arbitrary mind, for the conversion of his kinsmen. Every audience which the treasurer obtained was spent in arguments about the authority of the church and the worship of images. Rochester was firmly resolved not to abjure his religion, but he had no scruple about employing in self-defence artifices as discreditable as those which had been used against him. He affected to speak like a man whose mind was not made up, professed himself desirous to be enlightened if he was in error, borrowed popish books, and listened with civility to popish divines. He had several interviews with Leyburn, the vicar apostolic, with Godden, the chaplain and almoner of the Queen Dowager, and with Bonaventure Giffard, a theologian trained to polemics in the schools of Douai. It was agreed that there should be a formal disputation between these doctors and some Protestant clergymen. The king told Rochester to choose any ministers of the established church, with two exceptions. The prescribed persons were Tillotson and Stillingfleet. Tillotson, the most popular preacher of that age, and in manners the most inoffensive of men, had been much connected with some leading Whigs, and Stillingfleet, who was renowned as a consummate master of all the weapons of controversy, had given still deeper offence by publishing an answer to the papers which had been found in the strongbox of Charles II. Rochester took the two royal chaplains who happened to be in waiting. One of them was Simon Patrick, whose commentaries on the Bible still form a part of theological libraries. The other was Jane, a vehement Tory, who had assisted in drawing up that decree by which the University of Oxford had solemnly adopted the worst follies of Filmer. The conference took place at Whitehall on the 30th of November. Rochester, who did not wish it to be known that he had even consented to hear the arguments of popish priests, stipulated for secrecy. No auditor was suffered to be present except the king. The subject discussed was the real presence. The Roman Catholic divines took on themselves the burden of the proof. Patrick and Jane said little, nor was it necessary that they should say much, for the Earl himself undertook to defend the doctrine of his church, and, as was his habit, soon warmed with conflict, lost his temper, and asked with great vehemence whether it was expected that he should change his religion on such frivolous grounds. Then he remembered how much he was risking, began again to dissemble, complimented the disputants on their skill and learning, and asked time to consider what had been said. Slow as James was, he could not but see that this was mere trifling. He told Barillon that Rochester's language was not that of a man honestly desirous of arriving at the truth. Still, the king did not like to propose directly to his brother-in-law the simple choice, apostasy or dismissal. But 3 days after the conference, Barillon waited on the treasurer, and with much circumlocution and many expressions of friendly concern, broke the unpleasant truth. "Do you mean," said Rochester, bewildered by the involved and ceremonious phrases in which the intimation was made, "that if I do not turn Catholic, the consequence will be that I shall lose my place?" "I say nothing about consequences," answered the wary diplomatist. "I only come as a friend to express a hope that you will take care to keep your place." "But surely," said Rochester, "the plain meaning of all this is that I must turn Catholic or go out." He put many questions for the purpose of ascertaining whether the communication was made by authority, but could extort only vague and mysterious replies. At last, affecting a confidence which he was far from feeling, he declared that Barillon must have been imposed upon by idle or malicious reports. "I tell you," he said, "that the king will not dismiss me, and I will not resign. I know him, he knows me, and I fear nobody." The Frenchman answered that he was charmed, that he was ravished to hear it, and that his only motive for interfering was his sincere anxiety for the prosperity and dignity of his excellent friend the treasurer. And thus the two statesmen parted, each flattering himself that he had duped the other. Meanwhile, in spite of all injunctions of secrecy, the news that the Lord Treasurer had consented to be instructed in the doctrines of Popery had spread fast through London. Patrick and Jane had been seen going in at that mysterious door which led to Chiffinch's apartments. Some Roman Catholics about the court had, indiscreetly or artfully, told all, and more than all, that they knew. The Tory churchmen waited anxiously for fuller information. They were mortified to think that their leader should even have pretended to waver in his opinion, but they could not believe that he would stoop to be a renegade. The unfortunate minister, tortured at once by his fierce passions and his low desires, annoyed by the censures of the public, annoyed by the hints which he had received from Berlin, afraid of losing character, afraid of losing office, repaired to the royal closet. He was determined to keep his place, if it could be kept by any villainy but one. He would pretend to be shaken in his religious opinions, and to be half a convert. He would promise to give strenuous support to that policy which he had hitherto opposed, but, if he were driven to extremity, he would refuse to change his religion. He began, therefore, by telling the king that the business in which His Majesty took so much interest was not sleeping, that Jane and Giffard were engaged in consulting books on the points in dispute between the churches, and that, when these researches were over, it would be desirable to have another conference. Then he complained bitterly that all the town was apprised of what ought to have been carefully concealed, and that some persons, who from their station might be supposed to be well informed, reported strange things as to the royal intentions. "It is whispered," he said, "that if I do not do as your majesty would have me, I shall not be suffered to continue in my present station." The king said, with some general expressions of kindness, that it was difficult to prevent people from talking, and that loose reports were not to be regarded. These vague phrases were not likely to quiet the perturbed mind of the minister. His agitation became violent, and he began to plead for his place, as if he had been pleading for his life. "Your majesty sees that I do all in my power to obey you. Indeed, I will do all that I can to obey you in everything. I will serve you in your own way. Nay," he cried, in an agony of baseness, "I will do what I can to believe as you would have me. But do not let me be told, while I am trying to bring my mind to this, that if I find it impossible to comply, I must lose all. For I must needs tell your majesty that there are other considerations." "Oh, you must needs," exclaimed the king with an oath. For a single word of honest and manly sound, escaping in the midst of all this abject supplication, was sufficient to move his anger. "I hope, sir," said poor Rochester, "that I do not offend you. Surely your majesty could not think well of me if I did not say so." The king recollected himself, protested that he was not offended, and advised the treasurer to disregard idle rumours, and to confer again with Jane and Giffard. After this conversation, a fortnight elapsed before the decisive blow fell. That fortnight Rochester passed in intriguing and imploring. He attempted to interest in his favour those Roman Catholics who had the greatest influence at court. He could not, he said, renounce his own religion, but, with that single reservation, he would do all that they could desire. Indeed, if he might only keep his place, they should find that he could be more useful to them as a Protestant than as one of their own communion. His wife, who was on a sickbed, had already, it was said, solicited the honour of a visit from the much-injured Queen, and had attempted to work on Her Majesty's feelings of compassion. But the Hydes abased themselves in vain. Peter regarded them with peculiar malevolence, and was bent on their ruin. On the evening of the 17th of December, the Earl was called into the royal closet. James was unusually discomposed, and even shed tears. The occasion, indeed, could not but call up some recollections which might well soften even a hard heart. He expressed his regret that his duty made it impossible for him to indulge his private partialities. It was absolutely necessary, he said, that those who had the chief direction of his affairs should partake his opinions and feelings. He owned that he had very great personal obligations to Rochester, and that no fault could be found with the way in which the financial business had lately been done. But the office of Lord Treasurer was of such high importance that, in general, it ought not to be entrusted to a single person, and could not safely be entrusted by a Roman Catholic king to a person zealous for the Church of England. "Think better of it, my lord," he continued. "Read again the papers from my brother's box. I will give you a little more time for consideration, if you desire it." Rochester saw that all was over, and that the wisest course left to him was to make his retreat with as much money and as much credit as possible. He succeeded in both objects. He obtained a pension of £4,000 a year for two lives on the post office. He had made great sums out of the estates of traitors, and carried with him in particular Gray's bond for £40,000, and a grant of all the estate which the Crown had in Gray's extensive property. No person had ever quitted office on terms so advantageous. To the applause of the sincere friends of the established church, Rochester had, indeed, very slender claims. To save his place, he had sat in that tribunal which had been illegally created for the purpose of persecuting her. To save his place, he had given a dishonest vote for degrading one of her most eminent ministers, had affected to doubt her orthodoxy, had listened with the outward show of docility to teachers who called her schismatical and heretical, and had offered to cooperate strenuously with her deadliest enemies in their designs against her. The highest praise to which he was entitled was this, that he had shrunk from the exceeding wickedness and baseness of publicly abjuring, for lucre, the religion in which he had been brought up, which he believed to be true, and of which he had long made an ostentatious profession. Yet he was extolled by the great body of churchmen as if he had been the bravest and purest of martyrs. The Old and New Testaments, the martyrologies of Eusebius and of Fox, were ransacked to find parallels for his heroic piety. He was Daniel in the den of lions, Shadrach in the fiery furnace, Peter in the dungeon of Herod, Paul at the bar of Nero, Ignatius in the amphitheatre, Latimer at the stake. Among the many facts which prove that the standard of honour and virtue among the public men of that age was low, The admiration excited by Rochester's constancy is, perhaps, the most decisive. In his fall, he dragged down Clarendon. On the 7th of January, 1687, the Gazette announced to the people of London that the Treasury was put into commission. On the 8th arrived at Dublin a dispatch formally signifying that in a month Tyrconnell would assume the government of Ireland. It was not without great difficulty that this man had surmounted the numerous impediments which stood in the way of his ambition. It was well known that the extermination of the English colony in Ireland was the object on which his heart was set. He had, therefore, to overcome some scruples in the royal mind. He had to surmount the opposition, not merely of all the Protestant members of the government, not merely of the moderate and respectable heads of the Roman Catholic body, but even of several members of the Jesuitical cabal. Sunderland shrank from the thought of an Irish revolution, religious, political, and social. To the Queen, Tyrconnell was personally an object of aversion. Powis was therefore suggested as the man best qualified for the viceroyalty. He was of illustrious birth, he was a sincere Roman Catholic, and yet he was generally allowed by candid Protestants to be an honest man and a good Englishman. All opposition, however, yielded to Tyrconnell's energy and cunning. He fawned, bullied, and bribed indefatigably. Peter's help was secured by flattery. Sunderland was plied at once with promises and menaces. An immense price was offered for his support, no less than an annuity of £5,000 a year from Ireland, redeemable by payment of £50,000 down. If this proposal were rejected, Tyrconnell threatened to let the King know that the Lord President had, at the Friday dinners, described His Majesty as a fool who must be governed either by a woman or by a priest. Sunderland, pale and trembling, offered to procure for Tyrconnell supreme military command, enormous appointments, anything but the viceroyalty, but all compromise was rejected, and it was necessary to yield. Mary of Medina herself was not free from suspicion of corruption. There was in London a renowned chain of pearls, which was valued at £10,000. It had belonged to Prince Rupert, and by him it had been left to Margaret Hughes, a courtesan who, towards the close of his life, had exercised a boundless empire over him. Tyrconnell loudly boasted that with this chain he had purchased the support of the Queen. There were those, however, who suspected that this story was one of Dick Talbot's truths, and that it had no more foundation than the calumnies which 26 years before he had invented to blacken the fame of Anne Hyde. To the Roman Catholic courtiers generally, he spoke of the uncertain tenure by which they held offices, honours, and emoluments. The King might die tomorrow, and might leave them at the mercy of a hostile government and a hostile rabble. But if the old faith could be made dominant in Ireland, if the Protestant interest in that country could be destroyed, there would still be, in the worst event, an asylum at hand to which they might retreat, and where they might either negotiate or defend themselves with advantage. A Popish priest was hired with the promise of the Mitre of Waterford to preach at St. James's against the Act of Settlement, and his sermon, though heard with deep disgust by the English part of the auditory, was not without its effect. The struggle which patriotism had for a time maintained against bigotry in the royal mind was at an end. "There is work to be done in Ireland," said James, "which no Englishman will do." All obstacles were at length removed, and in February 1687 Tyrconnell began to rule his native country with the power and appointments of Lord Lieutenant, but with the humbler title of Lord Deputy. His arrival spread dismay through the whole English population. Clarendon was accompanied, or speedily followed, across St. George's Channel by a large proportion of the most respectable inhabitants of Dublin, gentlemen, tradesmen, and artificers. It was said that 1,500 families emigrated in a few days. The panic was not unreasonable. The work of putting the colonists down under the feet of the natives went rapidly on. in a short time, almost every privy councillor, judge, sheriff, mayor, alderman, and justice of the peace was a Celt and a Roman Catholic. It seemed that things would soon be ripe for a general election, and that a House of Commons, bent on abrogating the Act of Settlement, would easily be assembled. Those who had lately been the lords of the island now cried out, in the bitterness of their souls, that they had become a prey and a laughing-stock to their own serfs and menials, that houses were burnt and cattle stolen with impunity, that the new soldiers roamed the country, pillaging, insulting, ravishing, maiming, tossing one Protestant in a blanket, tying up another by the hair and scourging him, that to appeal to the law was vain, that Irish judges, sheriffs, juries, and witnesses were all in a league to save Irish criminals, and that, even without an Act of Parliament, the whole soil would soon change hands. For that, in every action of ejectment tried under the administration of Tyrconnel, judgment had been given for the native against the Englishman. While Clarendon was at Dublin, the Privy Seal had been in the hands of commissioners. His friends hoped that it would, on his return to London, be again delivered to him. But the King and the Jesuitical cabal had determined that the disgrace of the Hydes should be complete. Lord Arundel of Wardour, a Roman Catholic, received the Privy Seal. Bellasyse, a Roman Catholic, was made First Lord of the Treasury, and Dover, another Roman Catholic, had a seat at the board. The appointment of a ruined gambler to such a trust would alone have sufficed to disgust the public. The dissolute Etheridge, who then resided at Ratisbon as English envoy, could not refrain from expressing, with a sneer, his hope that his old boon companion, Dover, would keep the king's money better than his own, in order that the finances might not be ruined by incapable and inexperienced papists. The obsequious, diligent, and silent Godolphin was named a commissioner of the Treasury, but continued to be chamberlain to the Queen. The dismission of the two brothers is a great epoch in the reign of James. From that time it was clear that what he really wanted was not liberty of conscience for the members of his own church, but liberty to persecute the members of other churches. Pretending to abhor tests, he had himself imposed a test. He thought it hard, he thought it monstrous, that able and loyal men should be excluded from the public service solely for being Roman Catholics. Yet he had himself turned out of office a treasurer whom he admitted to be both loyal and able solely for being a Protestant. The cry was that a general proscription was at hand, and that every public functionary must make up his mind to lose his soul or to lose his place. Who indeed could hope to stand where the Hydes had fallen? They were the brothers-in-law of the king, the uncles and natural guardians of his children, his friends from early youth, his steady adherents in adversity and peril, his obsequious servants since he had been on the throne. Their sole crime was their religion, and for this crime they had been discarded. In great perturbation, men began to look round for help, and soon all eyes were fixed on one, whom a rare concurrence, both of personal qualities and of fortuitous circumstances, pointed out as the deliverer. End of part 20. End of chapter 6.